This is Steven Soderbergh.
And this is Mike Nichols.
And we're here to discuss Catch-22.
Which was many years ago now.
31?
30?
Well, when it was released.
Yes.
So this will be the 31st anniversary edition. And it has a nice round sound to it.
I think it suits the picture to have a 31st anniversary edition.
Well, let's talk about this opening a little bit, which is really spectacular. Was this something Wayne Fitzgerald did while you were down there, or did he go back down, or do you remember how this came about?
He went back down. I sent him down to get this, and they did the, what is it called, time stop?
Time-lapse, yeah.
Time-lapse shot, and, but of course what I hadn't figured out is that with a week to 10 days after it was released, it was just full of scratches.
Right.
And also people got very nervous because you thought the sound was off.
Because it's so quiet.
It's right? So quiet for yeah. A long time.
Now, David Watkin, whose credit just came up, terrific cinematographer, I read you had seen a lot of his work, but especially Charge of the Light Brigade.
Oh, yes.
Which is spectacular.
He's a great DP and a great and very funny man. Watkin is interested in the light, and basically we could only shoot it sort of from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. It was when we were properly backlit to satisfy Watkin, and it's how we got the look.
Right.
And Watkin didn't interest himself so much in what the camera would do as much as what the light would be, and I worked a lot of those things out between McCabe and me.
The sound coming up. We're about to go into this sequence where the planes are sort of waking up and taking off, which is pretty extraordinary. Obviously, we should mention that this entire base and landing strip was built.
Indeed, it was built. We got down there ready to start. We hadn't built anything yet, and the mayor met our little plane and said, "We have permission from all the owners of the land. This shot, this is the shot for which we had built a
right.
concrete ramp." Which
this is a long, long take.
Yes. And this push-in was all on a ramp. And the mayor said, "I've got permission from all the owners except one, and we've given him till Friday." And I said, "What'll happen Friday if he doesn't say yes?" He said, "We kill him." The mayor really wanted us there.
Clearly.
Buck came in one day. We used to get together every day and talk and work. He came in one day and he said he had been thinking over the weekend, over whatever it was, what about doing something related to the montages we had done in The Graduate, in which Benjamin was in this place and that place.
And lines would be repeated or from with transitions. And
right, and that we made that circular structure between Benjamin at home and Benjamin with Mrs. Robinson in the hotel. And Buck said, what if we did that? And I said, that was a very good idea, because the novel did suggest a kind of circular underneath.
Mm-hmm.
He then put it together in that way, and I thought that it was the answer for us. I always regretted here that many people don't know and never know that this is Nate Lee's whore.
Even in the very last one where she
somehow
screams?
Even when she screams it, and they somehow don't put it together with this event, this stabbing. And I think that I could have made it clearer had I known they wouldn't know.
Start our. That was our first sort of flashback. I mean, did you guys talk about just this whole idea of structuring the film as a dream or as some sort of fever dream?
Absolutely. More precisely,
absolutely. And again, I would like to have been a little more aware of taking the audience by the hand and leading them through this extremely confusing series of events. When is what's taking place?
Right.
Although, like with all such devices, if you just give up and go with it, it does, I hope, become clear.
Colonel Cathcart isn't even here.
Who said anything about Colonel Cathcart?
Colonel Point isn't here either.
Who said anything about Colonel Point?
What son of a bitch do you hate then?
What son of a bitch is here?
You don't make any sense.
You don't even know who you hate.
You've got a persecution card.
You're damn right I am.
This is a good scene, I think. It's reasonably faithful to the book. There's a lot of dialogue in here from...
Yes, this is one of the ones that we tried to keep as it was in the book. And you get a sense of the buddies at work.
Quite a remarkable cast. What was that process like, putting it together? Was Arkin in your mind just without question?
From the beginning, yes. He and I talked about it for such a long time.
Then I'd be a damn fool to think any different. You know what you ought to do? You ought to have your head examined.
There's nothing wrong with it.
Oh, I love Jack Gilford.
I love Jack Gilford, too.
And how... I spoke to him once about the film, and he said, I have to say, when we were doing it, I wasn't quite sure what it was about. He said, later on, I felt that I got a handle on it and that it had something to do with corporations and the, you know, sort of what we would now call synergy. And he thought later that it was quite prescient in its privatization of certain things that we always assumed would not be corporately held. But he said while we were doing it, I wasn't quite sure what was happening.
I think that was really true as we went, because we were so completely out of order. Here, by the way, we reshot all this. We did a version first when we first got there with all the other guys running to their planes.
You got rid of all the extras. I remember hearing about
extras.
That. I think that was a great idea.
I thought, when I saw what we'd shot with all the extras, I said, it's just an Air Force movie. And as soon as we got rid of the extras, you began to get a little more sense of a dream and of that these guys are here alone, which is, of course, impossible.
Right.
And it seemed more correct.
Yeah, the complexity of some of these shots is really daunting. And this is And doing things like this is a sort of characteristic of the we can call it the first phase of your career. And when you came back and did Silkwood, you'd sort of stopped doing that, the long, complicated masters. Was that something you thought about pretty consciously?
Yes, I thought about it consciously. I didn't consciously make a change. The long takes began to seem to me more self-regarding, and that cutting a lot began to excite me and began to give me the pleasures that most directors have right away. That's how you start. And I came to it very late, and love montage, of course, because it's one of the newer things in work for me.
Good afternoon, men. This is Major Dave.
I think that with all the advantages that takes like this give you, that it brings a certain theatrical quality that isn't always desirable.
Since the enemy is probably listening, and there's no reason I can think of to tell him exactly where we're going to strike.
That's the stupidest, goddamn thing I ever heard. He's like,
that's right. Weather conditions have improved.
That's an amazing shot.
That's an amazing
shot. How were they at the end of the runway, or did they go even further beyond the runway?
They were at the end of the runway, and the camera was hundreds and hundreds of feet away with the longest lens there was at the time.
Right.
And I remember Watkins' great excitement, because he, of course, knew better than anyone else what we had before we saw it.
Right. And I remember Buck Henry telling me that these planes, as they were being arranged to take off for the film, were sort of violating every rule that you would follow if you were actually doing this in real life. He said they were so close together, well within the prop wash of each other.
Did he tell you about the one that got out of control?
No, I read about it, but what
we were shooting from that very tower that Balsam and Benjamin are just in, and one of them got in the slipstream of the plane in front of him and came directly for us. And I have very slow reactions. When I looked up, everyone was gone. The plane had missed us. And our largest extra, because we did have some out of frame and doing other stuff, was about 6'6", and he was on the ground and he had footprints the length of his body because the company had run over him getting away from the plane.
This is just spectacular, the way they shimmy.
Yeah. Of course, nobody knew that until we did I mean, we didn't know it until we did that.
Right. I gather Frank Talman, who orchestrated all of the aerial stuff, was quite a character.
He was great.
There's a description in one of the stories that Buck published, the diaries, that you were talking with him about how to shoot in the cockpit, and you'd finally come up with an idea of where to put everyone, where the camera would be and where the actors would be, and you said, how would that work? And he said, Mike, where's the pilot going to sit?
Yes, that's true. It's a true story.
This is a pretty nice shot here. That the reset on this, I imagine, was more than a few minutes.
Well, it was the next day.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, because it had to be 2:15
for Watkins.
For Watkins. This was the only time this would work.
Oh, God.
So this is a shot that we used to do every day at 2:15.
No matter what else was going on.
Yes, because there was no other possibility. A lot of these things had to be done at the same time of day.
A great split diopter shot.
Yes.
Well, Buck has a theory that comedy shouldn't be backlit. Did he talk to you about that?
No, he's never said that to me, but I certainly agree with him.
Now?
Yeah, that this look, which is extraordinary,
yeah,
was in some ways inimical both to comedy and to feeling.
Hmm.
That it did this kind of depersonalizing that is also part of all this.
Right.
But it doesn't support comedy or emotion. I would do it again in this case. Many things I would do differently, but the look seems to me a good trade.
I think so for this. I have to say, I think it's literally one of the best photograph films I've ever seen. And for the locale and the period, I'd hate to see it shot differently, I have to say.
I think it was right.
And in Palermo, sir, 10,000 gallons of the finest Italian olive oil. The Sicilians need blankets. It would be a fair trade, sir. There's an interested party in Sardinia. All we need is the cooperation of the...
Now, how many takes on this one?
Well, many takes on this one. And what happens at the end of...
I'm assuming you have another plane already burning.
Precisely.
Yeah.
But the fact it is not already burning... This was a surprise that the crew rigged for me. They actually blew this plane up, but they did it just before we got there.
Really?
Yeah. They did it as a surprise for me. They were so happy to surprise me, but they didn't check on where the camera would be when. So we missed.
It was too early.
It was too early. But we had signed something with the Mexican government promising that we would take out all the planes we brought in because we had the sixth largest air force in the world. And they were worried that we would take out fewer planes than we left there. So we couldn't keep blowing up planes.
Right.
With the colonel's permission, I'd like to show him...
Now, John Voight at this point, this is pre-Midnight Cowboy.
Pre-Midnight Cowboy.
Right. What had you seen him in? Was he in plays or...
Wait a minute, is it pre-Midnight Cowboy?
Well, it was pre its release, for sure, because you started in January 69 shooting.
I think I just met Voight and thought he was Milo, and thought he was the perfect Milo.
I think he is too, actually.
I'm not sure that I had seen Midnight Cowboy, and yet, because of Dustin... Because it was Dustin's next interesting part after the graduate.
Right.
It's possible that I had seen Midnight Cowboy.
Cotton?
Yes, sir. Cotton is a particularly liquid commodity.
How much?
How was Martin Balsam?
He was wonderful. And he was... The second actor in this part is a very, very difficult part. It was hard to cast and hard to play. Because all the enlisted men, you know how they feel. But... We couldn't find the way into making fun of the officers.
Right. Here we have some front projection. This is spectacular looking stuff. It still really holds up, I think. I gather you had every light in the Western Hemisphere on the soundstage at Paramount.
Oh, for weeks. We worked on this front projection stuff for weeks. And my... strange obsession with staying in one shot and not cutting, of course, made it even more of a nightmare.
Right.
Because we had to have long, long plates.
Oh, right. Background plates,
yeah.
Right.
Don't worry about it. What am I supposed to do if I have to bail out? Use my handkerchief! That's the kind
of... Grodin is fantastic in this.
Grodin is wonderful.
I think it's one of the most successful characterizations, actually.
Grodin had not long before done for me... A great test for the graduate.
Right.
Really great. He was so funny. He just didn't look like that kid somehow. He was too much of an average guy. But I wanted to use him as much as possible.
Now, how would you rehearse a scene like this, for instance?
Well, we would just... time it out with the plate, and that the camera was on rubber bands bouncing through all this. And we had rehearsed, we'd rehearsed for a couple of weeks before we started shooting. And so...
But this is great. I think we're there. And then you would just keep going until...
Yes. And they knew it. They knew it and knew where we were in the scheme, as it were, by the time we got to these shots. This was all afterwards, after all.
Yes.
This was late on the stage.
This was your last phase of production after Rome?
Yes.
God, it's great looking stuff.
Again, I think somehow, some of the time I sacrificed clarity for this style.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't always that easy to know physically what's happening, which turns out to add to the dream feeling.
Yeah, in this case, absolutely. I'm surprised you got usable tracks at all, because I know it was quite noisy.
It was very noisy, and they did a lot of screaming. But it is so noisy, and
that it sort of works.
Yeah.
I smell something there.
This was all McCabe
shaking and
shaking the camera.
Unbelievable! It's really. I wasn't sure whether it was done optically or not. Although it didn't seem to be, because the grain is good.
He did it all by hand, and then, you know, of course they shook the mock up and everything.
Right.
The main thing was him and his rubber bands. Everywhere I go, people are saying, "Help him, help him, help who? Help the bombardier? I'm the bombardier. I'm all right." It's ever, it somehow stays in your head,
yeah,
that interchange. Then help him. Yossarian is an everyman that's so easy to identify with. He's really Schweik in a way, isn't he?
Right.
And the feeling of being the little guy caught in the middle, and Arkin's deliberate, witty inexpressiveness,
mm-hmm,
you know, seem to go together so well.
I can only imagine part of the impact of the novel had to do with the fact that taking a lot of the stances that the book takes during a war that was viewed as a good war and a just war and a very clear war must have caught a lot of people sort of off guard. And it certainly, you know, the book came out in, what, 61, so this is,
yes,
pre-Vietnam as we know it. It's pretty remarkable when you think about it.
This is the scene that you never see on TV.
Yes, well, we'll see it here. Is this the first, in a studio picture, is this the first full frontal nudity that you can remember?
That I know of, yes. There was a lot of talk about it.
I mean, I think Blow Up would have been one of the early,
mm-hmm,
sort of mainstream, or, you know, it was an MGM film, but...
Wasn't it an Ecstasy? Wasn't that the big deal about Ecstasy?
Oh, Hedy Lamarr?
Yeah.
I guess so, but that was pre-Hays Code, right?
It was pre-Hays, and it was all anybody ever knew about the picture. There was nothing else in the picture.
All right, who wrote this dream sequence? Was this Buck? Or
yes,
was this
it was Buck.
Oh.
I asked how you were feeling.
And he was, you know, we were there so long. The whole thing was like a 6-month shoot. We all hung out endlessly waiting for the time of day that
you were allowed to shoot.
Right. And Perkins was such a master of games. He would hand out the yellow pads and say, all right, now we're going to see how many synonyms for vagina we can list. You know, that's how we would sit waiting for Watkin with page after page after page of synonyms.
That's beautiful, that composition, the guy in the window.
I like this shot very much.
That's great.
It seems to be able
now, that looks more like there might have been some lighting involved and you might not have had to wait all day.
That's true, it was. I think we built all this, and this is stone.
This is a set on the location, but built absolutely solidly.
Built like a house. We were crazy. And when we blow it up later, it's real stone buildings that are actually blowing up.
But look at that. I mean, look at that palette there, that sort of slate. The costume and the walls, and it's really, it seems like visually there are very few accidents in the
every orange was planned, you know. I mean, literally the orange in there, that was the only
piece of color.
Yeah.
If I can do anything to help you, anything at all,
you anything
like books or cigarettes. Toys?
No, I have everything I need. Thank you very much. You could do one thing for me.
What?
Well, if you could speak to me.
I guess we did this many times.
Were you in those days prone to do a lot of things?
Not that many even then. It's just that
they were complicated.
They were so complicated, yeah. And there was so much that could and did go wrong.
Right. Wanted to be that guy.
I think it came off quite easily, but still.
Now again, we're coming up on a sort of transition that you know, him screaming to the fall, and almost every transition in the film, there is a very deliberate transition in almost every sequence in the film, and Buck Henry said there were one or two that he never felt he quite solved. He couldn't remember which ones they were, but he remembered having a lot of discussions with you about transitions.
Yes, we worked them out so carefully, because if you commit to this structure, then you've got to have careful and useful transitions.
As a result, I would assume then most of the editorial work would have been within scenes, as opposed to you couldn't just start rearranging the movie.
No, although there is a few scenes later, in fact, the Cathcart scene, in which we did make large lifts and a couple of retakes to change things, because as you say, we were locked in, so locked into the transitions that we had to redo a couple of things
if you wanted to change the scenes. Right.
I don't know anything about being a squadron commander.
We all have to make sacrifices, Major.
I know that, sir. We'll be all
Norman Fell, the wonderful Norman Fell.
Oh, yeah. He was an old friend of mine, and we'd had such a good time with him as the landlord and the graduate. I had to have him as one of these guys. And this changing portrait on the wall, I worked that out with Silbert that we would do it then and there and just...
Oh, which?
You'll see. It was Roosevelt, yes.
Who is it?
Captain Tatman, sir. He's a group chaplain.
Well, what does he want?
I don't know, sir. Something to do with Captain Yossarian.
And now it's Churchill.
And then it's going to be Stalin.
You're a kid. I've never noticed that.
We just changed them every time they left it. They switched it.
I'd never noticed that. And I've seen the film a lot. That's amazing. Even during the transfer, I didn't notice.
It was just a little way to amuse ourselves.
I don't like people staring at me, Sergeant. People stare at me. Did you know that?
No, sir.
Where did your idea of casting Newhart come from? Was he just somebody you knew and...
Yeah, and liked and watched, and it just seemed right. He was the one who was least a part of all the actors pretty much knew one another. Yeah, and they had worked together and been in different Compass and Sick and City type of groups together, but Newhart came from other places, and he was such a funny guy. And he became...
I gather he was one of the people that was constantly trying to escape.
Oh, yes. He was one of the ones that suffered most. And he said, can't we get some movies down here and watch the movies, which we then actually started doing. He wanted some action. He wanted something going on.
Now, this thing on Phil's neck I always thought was an Invaders from Mars kind of reference. The implication that he was not human.
I never noticed it.
Yeah.
Either it was the costume people's contribution, or he really had something there. I wish it would come and go.
Yeah, that would have been good. And what was your sense of the mix between somebody like Newhart, who's primarily a comedian as opposed to an actor, and people like Norman Fell, perhaps, who were more straight actors? Were they comfortable, or was that odd for them?
They were comfortable. It was all so much about comedy, and jokes were so much part of our day on the set, and our life. You know, everybody ate together at the hotel, and Paula made it very exciting.
Paula Prentice,
because she would always pile her plate very full and then excuse herself during dinner and go and take like a 10-minute nap and come back, so that people were like timing her naps. And she was very eccentric and utterly beloved by all of us. And it was so much about jokes and kidding around, because it was the only way to make it bearable, the length of time away from everything.
This is another scene that plays really well, the two of them.
Yeah, they were very good together.
And, it definitely looks like the right time of day to shoot.
Yes.
And, I read Walken would just sort of lay on his back with a contrast filter and wait.
Just wait. Buck once said, when he was driving the Jeep, Walken rode on the hood for the length of the Jeep ride with his finder watching Buck. And Buck said to me afterwards, if you had told me, you know, a year ago that I'd be driving a Jeep with a man in a pink shirt and a picture hat watching me, I wouldn't have believed it. Because Watkins always wore a huge straw hat to keep the sun off him. This coming shot that Buck was referring to.
It's a long take. God, what an amazing set.
It wasn't amazing. Somebody told me it's still, part of it is still there. The landing strip is certainly still there. A tourist attraction.
Absolutely, sir.
May I ask where we're going? Where we're going? You are going to Colonel Cathcart's office. Now? That's the general idea. Padre, now.
Is there anything wrong, sir? I mean, have I done anything?
Well, I don't know, Padre. Have you? Are you and Captain Yossarian up to something?
I don't know what you mean, sir.
You don't? Huh? Well, then who does?
I don't know, sir.
You don't seem to know much about anything, do you, Father?
No, sir. Sir?
What is it?
It's not necessary to call me Father. I'm an Anabaptist.
Well, thanks for the correction.
What, did Buck ask for a part, or you just gave him one?
I just gave him one.
Just wanted him around. That was back, back when it was okay to have a writer around.
That was still all right. And a lot of Orson Welles came just for his time that he shot. It was a few weeks. And he liked to be given readings, and Buck had read his part all the time he wasn't there. And I just gave him Buck's readings because they were so good. And he was very pleased. He liked them and did them very well.
We'll get into Wells when he arrives.
As a matter of fact, Father, I know I can get my hands on an entire shipment of religious relics.
Yeah, this is the no extras thing. It's just such a good idea. It just would be it would be real and so wrong.
So wrong. It looked so wrong. I was really, until we figured it out, I was really depressed. Because I thought, I don't think this can work. And then we thought of it.
Yeah?
I think the Colonel wants to see me.
He does?
I believe so. I'm Chaplain Tapman.
You're Chaplain Tapman? Have a seat. I'll tell the Colonel you're here, Father.
Oh, it's not...
I'd had him in a play. I'd had Balaban in Plaza Suite. He was the bellboy. And our joke while we were shooting, because Bob Balaban is a Balaban, was that ultimately, when it was all over, this film would end up being owned by Bob Balaban. Because the Balabans, I think, still owned Paramount at that point.
Oh, that's fine.
You should report to the hospital. You could catch pneumonia.
Oh, no.
He's great in this. Although I read one review that complained that he looked too much like Art Garfunkel.
But he doesn't.
I didn't think so either, but there you have it.
I can't remember whether he had already played Snoopy in something or just seemed to us all to be Snoopy.
You're Sarian?
Yes, he's a friend of mine. Do you know him?
Well, yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I...
Captain Tapman!
Yes?
Perhaps you shouldn't fly anymore.
It's good practice.
Tapman, the Colonel is a very busy man.
Yes, yes, of course.
I would comment on the toilet scene, but I'm not sure what to say.
I feel much the same. Oh, you know what it's based on?
No.
It's based on Louis B. Mayer and Elizabeth Taylor.
You're kidding.
No.
You're kidding.
He would...
Who told you that story?
Elizabeth.
Oh, my God.
He would, when she was like 12, he would say, they'd say, Mr. Mayer wants to see you, and when she got up there, he'd be on the can.
Oh.
He did that to people in meetings.
Executive seems so boring now.
It was the source, it was largely the source of her hatred for the office.
Of everything.
And executive.
Oh, God. That's unbelievable.
You don't have to read the whole thing. I think you can get the point from the photographs. There's a full-page picture of a colonel...
Now, we had a scene in here that I cut out.
Oh, yeah?
In which he actually burned all the clothes that he'd been wearing when he took a dump. That's why you'll now see when Buck comes in...
An insert that looks different?
No, Buck is bringing a lot of new uniforms for him because he does that every time he has a bowel movement.
Ah, but that got left.
That somehow... We were able to dissuade ourselves of that.
There's something else?
Sir, it may be none of my business, but...
That shot of Perkins earlier where he's standing with the sun on him is really amazing. Was that... Do you recall if that was... You were waiting for the sun to be there? Or... Because it looks so... It looks intense in a way that arcs often don't.
I think we did wait for that.
And it has the heat waves in it and...
Yeah.
And it's none of their business either. Their business is to fly missions. Your business is to think of some short, catchy prayers that'll get me into the Saturday Evening Post. Now, good afternoon, Chaplain.
Yes, sir. Excuse me.
Excuse me, Padre.
Chaplain says the men are upset because I keep raising the number of missions.
You're Sarian.
What?
It's that Captain Yossarian. He's always bitching, always making...
This obviously will be a transition that we...
Right.
We're very committed to.
Yes.
Tear him apart. Smack him in the face.
Jab him in the kidneys.
Get rid of balls.
I hope he was well protected.
He was well protected. There were several cups involved.
Okay. Keep
your head down between your legs.
Harkin said also that it was he imagined very much like actually being in the military, that most of the guys sat around talking about women all day.
Not only was that true, and he said that something like that at the time, but I remember during one of the bull sessions about women that he said this great thing. He said, "Luckily, there are women who like every conceivable kind of guy." It's a very arcane observation. And indeed, that's what it did feel like, being in the service.
But you loved it, right? I mean, you said you were very happy making this movie.
Very happy all the time. They were bitching and complaining all the time because they had to sit around and wait with nothing to eat but conch and nothing to do but be in or look at the ocean. I got to shoot the movie.
Right.
And so I was completely happy. And I think the crew was happy. And I think Buck was happy.
Yeah, he said he had a great time. Mm. And as a matter of fact, he was resented, he felt, by many of the cast members for being in such a good mood all the time.
And just like in the Army, bitching, you know, became
an art form.
An art form. Yeah. It was so endless and so painful. And
it's an interesting thing. They had a hand in front of the lens. Mm-hmm. Now, here comes Mr. Wells.
Here he is now.
Now, Callie told me a story. I don't know if this is... I can only assume it was true. That when he first came, and when you were first on the set, that he, as you were doing something, he said something sort of vaguely, as, you know, like, is that sure, are you sure that's what you want? Or, and that you took him aside and you had a very brief, quiet conversation, Callie said, and then you came back to the set, and then he never did anything like that again. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that.
And he said, you've got to ask Mike what he said, because I never found out.
I don't remember that at all. Hmm. But what I do remember is that when we were shooting this scene, he said to Austin Pendleton, "Are you absolutely sure you want to do the line like that?" And Austin said, "Yes." Austin was not afraid. We were all so scared of him. And Austin was not.
I love Austin Pendleton.
Oh, he's great. Orson liked his uniform so much that he wore it all the time. He wore it when he wasn't shooting. He wore it in Wymouth.
Just walked around in it all the time?
Yeah.
You see, a lady is standing.
A chair for Dad's... For the lady.
And how many layers of... this is Suzanne Benton, right?
Yes.
And she had seven...
She had a lot of padding.
A lot of padding.
Well, what we found was it was very, very hard to look sexy in that
uniform.
In
that outfit, yeah.
Carry on.
What are we going to do now?
Now, I also heard that you told Richard Benjamin that basically he, in these sequences, he should behave the way you behaved around Orson Welles.
That's true. I did tell him that. I remember that.
It is now 1,115 hours minus 50, 49.
This is a sort of pleasant motif in war films, the horny GI sequence.
Yeah. We went fairly far with it. It was obviously Garfunkel's first, not only first movie, but the first time he ever acted. And there's some shot coming up in this scene in which he needed to smile. Not laugh, smile. And we were rolling and rolling. We couldn't get him to smile. And people were yelling things and making funny remarks and making faces at him to try to get him to smile. And he said, "I feel like a baby having its picture taken."
15, 14, 13, 12.
All right, at ease.
Now, for instance, I mean, how long would a scene like this have taken to shoot? A week? A few days?
Oh, a few days.
Yeah.
A few days.
One! Oh.
Orson had no patience.
Oh, really?
No. It was a job for him.
That's a very Wellesian shot. Yeah. No, deep focus. And,
he would ask people to give him their lines again in the middle of shots.
Of their shot, I heard.
Yes, also of their shot. He'd say, will you just read that again for me?
You mean I can't shoot whoever I want to?
But he was... also Orson Welles, and you never forgot it.
Right. That's because my half-wit daughter married you for God knows whatever. How old was he at this point? Was he in his 50s?
I would say early 50s.
Yeah.
The insubordinate son of a bitch. Go, but get him out of here.
Better do something.
All right, man, I think we... Oh, thanks to General Field for visiting with us today and cheering us all up. In his honor, I'd like to make an announcement.
And how did you come to... How did Art Garfunkel sort of come into the mix? That he'd mentioned to you that this was of interest to him? Or
no, it's just I had gotten friendly with Simon and Garfunkel. There is the smile.
Yeah.
What are you smiling at?
It's this. It's this scene. He just couldn't get cheerful for her. I'd become friends with both of them, and then he just seemed to me
to have a
the ideal
quality.
Innately. Yeah.
Yeah. I really do. Honest to God, I never felt anything like this before. And I've now here we are in Rome.
Yes, they came. These tanks were plastic. One guy could carry one over his head.
You're kidding.
And we came in the night, and we placed our tanks in Piazza Navona, and there was hysteria because they thought the Germans were back. The tanks weighed nothing.
And this is a scene, this dialogue, this interchange is something that Buck wrote, I think, about he thinks he's in love with her. How can you tell the difference? And
yes.
It's quite good.
It is good.
I mean, it's sort
it
of
really
seamless.
It captures the style of Heller, absolutely.
And there's one exchange coming up later that we talked about that he wrote that's absolutely brilliant, that Heller even said when he saw the film, I wish I'd thought of those. And Buck said that for me was
the
top.
Oh,
yeah, when we get there, I'll tell you which one it is. This is, again, the light in the perfect position.
And here's wonderful Peter Bonners, who did hang around for months and end up with this scene and nothing else. That was one of the cruel things about the method we were forced into with the long Mexican special light thing. That people waited and waited and waited and very often had very little to do.
He's dead!
You crazy bastard!
You'll be beneath contempt.
He's got a dirty mind, hasn't he, Osarian?
The dirtiest.
And, boy, you've cleared the whole... cleared a lot of the city behind you now.
Yeah. I lived at that house on the left at the end. I had an apartment there.
Send the other two away. Hasn't you... be angry with me for making a work for a money.
You're walking to work, then.
Exactly.
I swear, you fellas.
Come on, you sir, let's go.
John Calley called the studio when we first got here. He was a big practical joker. None of us can remember who ran Paramount at that point. I've tried for months, literally.
It wasn't Yablons?
No. It was pre-Evans.
Pre-Evans.
And I simply don't know who it was. But... Callie liked to terrorize him. And he called him and he said, I'm here we are in Rome, and I'm afraid Mike doesn't like Rome, and he wants to build it. And the guy said, Rome? And John said, yeah, he's disappointed in it. And he tortured him with it. But look at it.
Oh, yeah.
Nagley! Hey, Nagley, wait for me!
Here comes your one of the few uses of music, actually, we should mention in the entire film, other than Source.
Yes. People begged me not to do this. You know, obviously, Kubrick had just used the music. And it was tasteless and vulgar, and there was almost no excuse for it. And I just couldn't resist. I couldn't let it go. I thought it was such a good joke. If I did it again, I would probably take it out. But at the time, I didn't mind. Now, you'll see something nobody knows. In a moment, you will see...
During this transition?
Yes. Do you know who this cop is?
No.
It's Buck.
That's Buck?
Yes.
That's hilarious. I never would have recognized him in a million years.
No, it's not Buck anymore.
Right, that's a different guy.
Right. But I couldn't get this guy to do what Buck
did.
Needed.
Right.
So I said, Buck, put the thing on and do it.
That's
did it
great.
So beautifully.
This is a great that's a great transition.
Yeah, it is.
The white wall tires, whose idea was that?
That was Silbert. Silbert just painted them on the plane. He thought that the general should have white wall tires. And the shot coming up where we track behind the guys...
As they're running with him?
No, track behind the soldier.
Oh, as he enters.
That's me trying to steal the Leni Riefenstahl shot of Hitler, which I also have tried to steal later in the same movie, of Voight. You know, when he's standing up in the
car. Yeah.
And of course, you can't steal it unless you have thousands of people.
Right.
All right.
I also read that when Wells came, he had Bogdanovich in tow.
Perpetually interviewing him? Yes, absolutely. All the time. There's Mike in his face. And he also had his girlfriend, who was very nice and who was a sculptress and needed certain kinds of clay that we had to supply for her to continue her work.
This is...
Oh, yeah. It later became Mrs. Wells.
Oh, wow.
Now, here's the front projection
shot. That's spectacular.
This took a week because we kept getting our own shadow. And nobody had done front projection.
Other than Kubrick, right?
Exactly, right. Other than Kubrick. And who knew how they did it? We didn't know. I mean, we kept phoning and trying to get advice.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah, I like it very much. And over and over and over we would do it and get a shadow. And it's all, obviously, the plate is all the planes except ours.
Yeah, right.
And it...
I read somewhere that Bran Faron was involved.
He was.
He was 17 or something at the time.
He seemed mature enough, but there he was working on it with us.
He was just a whiz, I guess.
He was a whiz, and he was experimental, and he worked on some of it.
Ugh, look at that. That's not a cheap shot. Now, this is the shot that Wells had to build a little...
Exactly, you know about this.
Yeah.
But we stopped production to build a little rig so that they wouldn't actually have to run behind the Jeep, which was not going very fast.
Mm-hmm.
But he wouldn't hear. Suddenly, you know, he paid no attention to any of these people. Suddenly, he was Captain Bountiful, and he... They must not be asked to run, so we stopped while they built the thing.
So they were on a little mini treadmill or something? Or?
They were just on a platform.
Right.
And got pulled behind the Jeep. Looks phony as hell if you look at it. And now comes the cut that Orson dictated. This. He said, just cut back. He said, it's a perfectly classic cut. I said, well, what about the steps? And he said, people won't worry about that. This is the Leni Riefenstahl shot.
Right.
I should live so long.
Beautiful. Again, 3/4 backlight everywhere you go.
All the time.
Sun following the camera lens.
Every time of day.
You're right. I mean, it looks about 2 o'clock. All the time.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. There's never...
I'd
never noticed that before. I guess you probably couldn't get away with that now.
I think not.
But
we were crazy.
All right, McWatt, what are you waiting for? Now, so that begs the question. You were there longer than planned?
Well, we were there... We planned to be there long to begin with, and then I think we were there somewhat longer than planned, yes. Come on, Dumbo. But, I mean, Watkin knew from the beginning that he would... Now, this... It was Wells. I said I want a really long pause here, and it was Wells who timed it.
Unless I miss my guess, Captain.
It may be the longest pause of this kind I've ever seen. Beautiful. In the theater, it works.
Yeah. Absolutely.
What are you looking at? Get back in the car, you smirking slut. Why aren't you wearing clothes, Captain?
I don't want to.
What do you mean you don't want to? Why the hell don't you?
Hold on, I just...
And then, again, this was at a point where you were... I know in his close-ups, he was asking for you to give him line readings.
In this coming up, he wanted line readings, and the one that I gave him, which is, you're a very weird person, Sarian, was Buck's. And he did it... I did it like Buck. You're a very weird person, you Sarian. And then he did it exactly like that and broke up because he thought it was such a pretty line reading. He was very sweet about it in that moment.
If he wants to receive a medal without any clothes on, what the hell business is it of yours?
It's my sentiments exactly, sir.
Here's your medal, Captain. You're a very weird person, Eusarion.
Thank you, sir.
This was my first experience of shooting a movie in a trance. You know, that partly because it was so huge and the ADs took over a lot, and you'd get up in the morning and they'd stop you driving onto the base and paint your car khaki, literally. Somebody could go spritz and put you in a khaki jumpsuit and say, "What are you doing?" They'd say, "Schmuck, we're doing the shot from the air today." And stuff like that.
Right.
And so I sort of gave up on physical stuff and let them do that. It was all planned. And I got in the kind of trance that I now trust. But it really worried me at the time. And I also knew all the time that something was wrong. That there were no moments.
That's it, you. But they wanted her to sleep with me.
Now, one of the things that I would imagine would have been difficult for you making a movie like this is that so much of your work is behavior-based and sort of reaction-based to certain events or circumstances, and this is so carefully constructed that it doesn't leave a lot of room to play.
Well, you've gone right to the heart of what was difficult for me and why I felt from first to last and now that it's not my kind of movie. I always thought that. This is not my kind of movie. Because it's not about interpersonal things at all. There are none. There is no subtext. There's nothing under. There is no underneath. When the underneath is what draws me. Why? It's why I make movies. The things people don't say.
Right.
There are no things people don't say in this. This is something else. And in some ways, because of that, I always felt a little at sea.
Was that something that you sort of discovered as you started shooting, or Absolutely. Were you worried about it earlier?
I was vaguely worried about it earlier. I couldn't really get a hold of the scenes the way I usually do. And then as we were shooting it, I had a kind of dream state of my own in which there was nothing beneath the scenes to mine. Mm-hmm. I had to let go of that tendency in myself, and I had to go with it. And it was a kind of trance-like thing where you just moved forward and trusted the scheme and the overall action.
Now, I would imagine that was also hard for the actors.
It was very
especially
hard.
Somebody like Arkin.
Arkin was so unhappy, I think partly for that reason, and partly all the time with nothing to do. And I remember once when he said to me, you know, having seen Dailies, he said, you know, I don't like my work. I don't like any of our work in this except Marty. Because you just had to move forward. There was nothing underneath.
There!
It's starting to hurt me.
Okay, hang on, I'll get you some morphine.
Now, one thing that we were talking about earlier when we spoke of Randall Jarrell, who you introduced me to and who wrote, I gather, a pretty famous war poem, Death of the Ball Turret Gunner.
Yes.
And we were sort of speculating whether Heller might have read that. I wrote down the last line of the poem, which is, when I died, they washed me out of the turret with a hose. The poem itself seems to echo the book, especially.
It's hard to imagine that Heller wouldn't have read Jarrell anyway. He was a minor, he was never very famous, but he was a minor hero as a poet then, and I just figure he did. Heller's sources are so completely digested anyway. It seems to be, you know, sprung full-blown from his head, but of course nothing is, and he just digested whatever it was.
I don't give a damn about the syndicate.
Here, have a tomato.
I don't want all your goddamn tomatoes. I don't want no
They're not my tomatoes. They're the syndicate's tomatoes. Our tomatoes. Just as these are our statues. In fact, that's...
It's another long, intricate take.
Oh, this was infinitely complex.
Well, no, in point of fact, I traded our diesel engines for the statues.
I don't have any diesel engines.
I didn't say your, I said our. I got the diesel engines for 2 plane loads of lumber and 100 pairs of shoes and the parachute.
Well, I don't think the men in this squadron will be very happy when they find out what you've been doing.
Well, for heaven's sake, don't they understand? We're going to come out...
Now, this is the death of Hungry Joe coming up, which for a long... I mean, I just couldn't figure out how you did. It was done so well.
We were very proud of ourselves for this. This was Alan McCabe's idea.
The him holding the piece of screen?
Yes, it was front projection screen, and it just worked perfectly.
In essence, for the shot where he falls back over, we should explain that he's... It looks like a half a body.
Yes.
But in fact,
he's holding a
piece of the front projection screen.
Yes.
It's really it's a brilliant idea.
It's a great idea. I've never had very great luck with special effects done afterwards. You know, I know what they are and what they can be, but it's often very hard to capture the interest of a special effects company under $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
I trust things you figure out in camera much more.
It's perfect.
Yeah, we of course had to do it many times because the angle of it had to be right.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. How'd you crash this plane?
It just flies past a mountain. And we have a little dust explosion we do as it flies past.
You're kidding.
That's all it is.
I thought you'd crash that plane into the mountain.
It looks good.
It's perfect.
Yeah. I seem to remember that Osteen and I made some frame cuts so that the timing was exactly perfect.
It's a great sound too. It's very distant and sort of hollow. It's terrific. But I, for the life of me, I thought you took another plane up, you know, in a sort of glider situation and just let it go.
No.
Oh, I gotta watch this closely now. Of course, on television, this shot doesn't make much sense.
No, that's the whole thing. You rarely get to see these things full screen.
Is everybody looking at the same thing?
Probably not. We certainly had an eye point. But it was
here
moving
we go.
All the time.
Oh my God, that's brilliant. That is brilliant.
And there's no reason not to do frame cuts because there's nothing moving at all, so you could just get it exactly simultaneous.
Wow, what a great idea. This is what I like about movies.
Yeah, me too.
Had you worked with Guilford before on stage?
No. We'd known each other, of course, you know, from being around nightclubs and working comedy together, but we'd never worked together. He was in a show called The World of Sholem Aleichem, in which he played Bonche Schweig beautifully, the guy who all he wanted from life was a little hot roll with a little butter, and then he's run over and And then he goes to heaven and God sends, oh, no, I've screwed it up completely. Forget it.
That's a different...
He never asked for anything. I'll tell you some other time.
I just wondered if you wanted to say anything.
This is a good scene, too, I think.
I like this scene.
Yep.
I like the actors very much in this scene.
Yep.
When the guns go off, we had decided...
I'm assuming that tree was stuck there? Or
that tree was really there.
Really?
And we composed ourselves for it.
Oh, that's great.
I wanted them to really jump, so I said, you know, let's get all these guns and shoot in the air behind them for the... surprise them for the reaction. And, of course, they knew what we were doing and did absolutely nothing when the guns went off, which was very funny.
The tree?
Yes, that's it.
That's just your Sarian.
Oh.
Yeah, light just in the right place.
Well, in that case, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures.
Hey!
It's a great exchange, the two of them.
Yeah.
Mark and sort of... It's just that you just can't imagine anybody else playing this part, actually.
No, he was your Sarian.
I want you to do something for me.
Does he like it now?
I gathered that he did, yeah. At least he felt, with some distance, that he could see the design.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, he said he was just confused. And Voight, I think, was a great choice because I think he makes the transition really well.
Very well.
I think that he plays the second half of it, especially the very end of it, just impeccably.
I hadn't seen this picture for many years, and then I had to check a print for something, somewhere, a festival or something. And I watched it with one of my kids. And it seemed to me, for the first half, like a sort of von Stroheim folly. And then somewhere around here...
It really takes hold, I think.
Yes.
I do, I agree.
Kid that got killed in my plane the other day.
Oh? What happened to him?
He got killed.
What? She's really terrific.
I love this actress. She became quite a big deal Italian actress in a number of art films, the names of which I don't know at the moment. She was wonderful, and she didn't speak a word of English.
It was all phonetic?
Yeah.
He died. You don't get any.
No, I think once, in a sense, once it's been set up and it starts to, in my mind, starts to take hold and tighten its grip. It really does work. The irony being that even though it's a comedy, the second half of the film is clearly more dramatic than the first half, and that seems to be the part that works the best.
You know, of course, that what happened was that just after it came out, MASH came out, and I had read the script of MASH, which was not good, and nothing like what the picture was. I mean, it was simply something else. And Altman came along, and he brilliantly had them improvise it, and he did what he did. It made MASH so alive and fresh and funny. And in some ways, they used MASH against us a lot, because everything that Catch couldn't have, the freedom and the wildness and the half-assed, improvised quality, made us seem even more stately.
Yeah, and the fact that the films are very different, intense.
War, you know, yeah. They were endlessly compared to one another.
I do. I want to marry
you. Not possible.
Why not?
Because you're crazy.
Why am I crazy?
Because you want to marry me.
Wait, you won't marry me because I'm crazy and you say I'm crazy?
The first actress I cast for this, we cast in Rome, went to Mexico for 4 months, and when I came back, she'd had her nose fixed.
Te amo molto.
How can you love a girl who is not a virgin?
Because I can't marry you.
Why you can't marry me? Just because you're not a virgin?
No, because you're crazy.
You're crazy.
Now, you know who this old guy is?
Marcel Dalio.
Yeah.
Who's French, right?
He's French. He's If you remember, he's the guy...
He's in Rules of the Game.
He's in Rules of the Game. He plays the Count, right. And he's in Grand Illusion. He plays right. The Jew. He was a great man. A great man. And it was after this scene. He did this scene, and he was so nervous. He wasn't getting a lot of jobs anymore. And I said, please know that we worship you here, and you can do anything you want. And he did this scene, and it was... remarkable, you know, and it's the first and last time in my working life that I've heard a crew applaud. It's nothing I've ever seen. And they applauded him, and he said, I said to the makeup man this morning, when you're an actor, you have to pray every morning for a small miracle because you can't make it come. It just has to come one more time.
And still, in existence, long after your country has been destroyed.
What are you talking
about? How was Garfunkel with him?
He was impressed and ready to do whatever he was told.
Persia was destroyed. Spain was destroyed.
How old would Dalio have been here, in his 70s?
Certainly in his 70s. I think late 70s.
And these interiors, would this have been in Rome?
This was in Rome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that you showed the film or had previews, but were they at a point where you could possibly go back and mess around, or were you basically done when you were showing them to audiences?
Well, we'd made some snips and adjustments and speed ups, and we did that reshoot eventually on a stage somewhere with Marty Balsam, with Cathcart, in the scene we've already seen. But it was the first preview I ever had of a film where I thought something's wrong. It's not a film anyway that leads to a huge audience reaction.
Nice to look at.
This life is not nice. I don't want her to do this.
Where do we go to America?
The first two films I made did lead to a huge audience reaction and cheering and carrying on and so forth. But there was a sense during the preview and, in fact, the run of it, that it was not completely connecting with the audience.
Oh, of course not.
No morality?
Oh, I'm a very moral man.
Yeah, well, the question is whether it can, because of what it is.
Exactly.
I mean, starting with the book.
If we succeed in being defeated,
you talk like a madman.
But I live like a sin.
I don't know what you could have done on a conceptual level to sort of, I don't know, make it more emotional, or it's not one of those pieces.
There are things I could have done.
What do you think?
I could have scored it.
Hmm.
I could have used a warmer actor, more connected to the audience for Usarian, like Dustin. And most of all, I could have made it for half what it cost. You know, not being so ambitious with the airplanes. There's a certain arrogance in all that. But it read as arrogance, but it was really just ignorance. I didn't know there were alternatives at the time. And nowadays, we know that if you want to make a movie like this, you know, you have
to make it on the cheap.
That's right. And that, of course, as you and I know, that's the real fun. Make it on the cheap, make it fast, make everybody work hard. That's the excitement of doing something that is not trying to be a mass movie. I didn't know all that. That would have been the answer, is to make this cheap.
No, but now we have the pleasure, at least for me, as a filmmaker, to watch a film made in a way that nobody works anymore. That you have those shots that you aren't allowed to do.
You can't do with back projection. You can't. Marty Rantzau said this should have been made with one plane. Well, should have for what? For the gross? Maybe.
Why the lease canceled?
I don't know. Milo says the base is on some kind of alert.
Oh, yeah. Cathcart raised the number of missions to 80.
80?
Yeah. He's mad because Captain O lost another airplane.
Where?
Ditch coming back from Bologna, went down in the Mediterranean.
Paramount was in some sort of transition at this point, or it was kind of...
It wasn't so much transitional as being run by somebody that no one can remember. There's a person called maybe Gordon Stuhlberg, who it might have been, but I'm not certain.
But Evans was there, wasn't he? He was an executive.
He was there, but not visible. He may not have been there yet. When was this? When did he become an executive? When did he become the head of Paramount, I wonder?
I want to say late 69, early 70, but I could be wrong.
Because this came out in 68, I guess.
Which?
Catch.
No, July 70.
July 70?
Yeah.
Evans wasn't there yet.
But Love Story was 70, and wasn't that his baby? But it was the end of the year.
Yeah, it must have all happened then.
Don't worry! Nothing's gonna happen to you that won't happen to the rest of us!
This is a terrific scene, too. I like that you never see Arkin. You just play Balaban. Balaban.
That was some of the fun with Osteen, that he always was ready to go strange places in cutting this stuff.
There's a lot of that in Carnal Knowledge as well, sort of just holding.
Carnal Knowledge was designed to do that, you know.
And it really works.
And I think it works because it's about unspoken things with and about the women.
Why what?
It's harder with content like Catch, because that question that you really ask yourself when you're shooting something, what's really happening here? There's no answer to it in Catch. That's what made it both so difficult to shoot.
And but the other question, right, that you say you should always ask, being, what is this like?
Yes.
Exactly.
Picking John?
For finishing a stove.
It's meant to be like what it was to be in the Air Force, but such an abstraction of it. And that's such a generality. There is no moment about which you can say, what is this like?
You're in there.
Or there isn't anyone in the squadron who wants to fly with you. You're a one-man disaster area.
They're crazy.
I agree with them.
You're crazy.
I love this little sequence of him walking around. It's really sort of beautiful and evocative. That looks like a little day for night action, maybe.
Well, and in fact, at this point, it begins to be about something. It begins to be about all their loneliness and separation from each other.
I'm assuming this, again, was probably day for night.
Yeah.
Or?
Great reaction here from Jack Guilford.
The whole serial aspect of the Dr. Nika incident, I always felt that somehow the movie had to prepare you for it, and we did as much as we could with the structure and with the look, of course. But can you be prepared for something surreal in a movie unless it's Cocteau, unless you're starting that way, unless that's the heart of it?
Or? He's dead.
Who's he?
Nobody you know.
Again, here's a completely surreal scene.
Well, this is interesting because Buck Henry said that he felt, and I don't know if you guys talked about this, that it was this scene more than any other that the audience sort of lost their bearings.
Yes.
I wonder why that is. It's really well played. It's not shot to be funny.
Rosarian, they came 5,000 miles to see you before you died.
What are you talking about? I'm not dying.
Of course you're dying. We're all dying.
Am I imagining things? You do a very slow, the light
It's
stops.
A stop change. It's a scene long
It's really
stop
slow.
Change.
Yeah. When we were doing the transfer, I thought we were going crazy.
We just endlessly creeping along change the stop, and that's what happens. It's a real, as it were, sunset. The thing is that
right. Was that the idea behind it in theory?
Yes.
Right.
This scene, both in the book and in the picture, is a sort of archetypal surrealistic scene in that you cannot explain it. You just have to give yourself to it, and either it evokes something or it doesn't. You know that story about Robert Frost reading his poetry to an audience?
And no.
A woman, they're meant to ask questions, and a woman says, I didn't understand that last poem. Could you explain it? And Robert Frost says, you mean you want me to say it again, only not as well? And it's a little bit that. You
right.
can't explain it. You either buy it or you don't.
But as you're saying, how do you prepare them for it?
That was the task, and I don't know that it was possible.
And I'll send you to Rome on a 5-day R&R.
Liam Dunn, I love him.
Oh, me too. And Elizabeth Wilson,
yeah,
a great actress.
Richard Libertini. And Arkin's great in the scene. I love the way he doesn't move his head. He's sort of paralyzed, and it's all in his eyes. It's very disturbing.
Well, and it is, in fact, all about his pain and despair at all the death around him.
Don't you know who I am?
Sure, I do. You're my brother, John.
He knows me.
It's so like movies, you know, to have a character who is entirely about people dying, him watching people die, and to have someone who's such a great actor and so deliberately inexpressive. And he's not a guy who makes faces.
His name's Usarian. He doesn't really know things too good anymore.
She can call me Harvey if she wants to.
Harvey.
And again, you're shooting all this in Mexico? Or would this
have been a was in Mexico with the backing.
Oh, it is the backing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to, time the stop change exactly
the
same
lines.
On him. Yeah.
I wish I could have seen the guys at Technicolor when this came through.
It took a lot of explaining.
Yeah.
Time to see you before you died.
What difference would it make?
We didn't want you to die by yourself.
What difference would it make?
Now you must be getting delirious. You keep saying the same thing over and over again.
Harvey.
I love the scene. I love the scene in the book. I just love what it is. And yet I have complete respect for people saying, what do you mean? Don't they know their own son? But it's all about guys in the army being interchangeable as far as the people who sent them are concerned.
Listen, kid. It's not bad.
Did you ever have any impulse to come back later each time? Or it seems to. Its rhythm is very, you know, in sync with the film. Did you worry about the repetition of it?
No, we loved the repetition of it and started out actually repeating it every time and then realized immediately in reading it that it's too much. You can't do it.
There! It's good! It's a good bandage! It's going to be okay, kid. We'll be home soon. Does the leg still hurt?
No.
Usarian? Hey, Usarian? You in there?
Well, we're coming up on a pretty sizable sequence here.
Well, yes, and, you know, just to go back to the dying soldier, it's very closely related to making a deal with the Germans to bomb your own base. It's the same gag, in a way.
He's going to kill the colonel.
Kafka?
Yes?
Dobbs is going to kill Colonel Kafka?
It is, in fact, what makes the book great. It's just that whether it translates or not is forever a question.
Man, that's a nice shot.
That's a nice shot.
All this night stuff is really beautiful. Talk a little about Watkins' approach to this.
Well, Watkins came up to me just before we did blowing up the base.
And you were blowing it up.
We were actually blowing up these stone buildings.
Oh, you're crazy. Crazy. You raise the number again and you know it.
With dialogue and stuff happening.
At the same time, doing it all. And he said to me, I'm doing something rather daring. I'm going to light this only with the explosions. He said, but... it's only 6,000 a day. And I said, 60,000. He said, I'm sorry, 60,000. It was enchanting. And indeed, that's what he did. His only light for when that happens is the explosions themselves.
I love all the landing lights, though, the sort of arc lights that are along the airstrip. They're really
great.
Fantastic.
And Buck's dialogue with headquarters in the background actually blowing up. They had one take, and his line was, there goes the bomb dump. And unfortunately, when it was really exploding, he said, there goes the dumb bump. Nobody was going to laugh. You know, we were all so terrified. We had one shot at it, and then we just looped it. It was fine.
Oh, my God.
Oh, what was his, when you cut, what did he...
then we laughed.
Why'd they turn the lights on? What the fuck?
Oh, here comes this light. This is great. Wow. Just burning a hole in the negative. Beautiful.
A great shot of Arlo. Look at that.
Oh, yeah. He was so brave.
Wow.
Watkins.
Oh, Lester, obviously, Richard Lester, I talked to at length about him, and he said he was a primitive in a way because his ideas were just so untraditional.
These are actual explosions.
You're blowing stuff up.
Yeah. We were crazy.
Oh, man. Some of those, I would assume you could have done again, but not the headquarters.
Precisely.
Right. Oh, this is just such beautiful stuff.
Direct hit on the mess hall, if you please. And number three. Hold on, number three. Yossarian, get off the field. Hey, Yossarian, you too, dog.
I made an argument to Lester that I think Watkins is the father of modern color cinematography, that all of his ideas to this day are the ideas that the best cinematographers use. You look at that shot of Voight here, the hot top light.
Absolutely.
Which you see all the time.
And like all innovators,
look at that.
That's my favorite shot.
Wow.
And like anyone who goes where no one has gone before, he got a lot of shit for it. You know, including from us often. We say, David, look at this. You can't see their faces. You know, I say, I'm going to print it up. You know, we didn't applaud him and kiss his feet right away. It took a long time because he was an innovator.
Did you reach that point during the shoot? or after?
During.
Oh, okay.
During. And he's one of those people that is absolutely impossible. I mean, he would do things like, say, he'd set up forever with the stand-ins. And then he'd say, ready, and the stand-ins couldn't get out because there were so many things built, flags and things built around them. You couldn't get the actors in. He had so many things you could make fun of. He was so totally endearing because he was so eccentric. And this is the scene where he says,
yeah, here it comes.
Oh, it's behind Arkin.
Yeah.
It's all part of the contract. There goes headquarters!
Wow. Gone. Buck Henry said they, just for laughs, that they put sort of twice the size of charge that they were originally going to do.
They always wanted to surprise us, the special effects guy.
What's that?
He said Nately.
Nately is dead.
I know that.
Very carefully placed
blood
stain.
How we work.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Waited hours for that to dry.
A little look around inside you. We're going to clean you out and stitch you up. Hey. You're Sari. Hmm? You've got your pal.
The first draft, I gather, was somewhat lengthy.
Yes.
And then you started paring it down, but I think you went into production with a script that was fairly long.
Before the cuts we made when we went to work, there were so many characters we had to drop, because you just do. PFC, Wintergreen, some of my favorites.
Did Hungry Joe have more material in the script than...
He did.
Is in the film.
He did. He had more material in the film, too. But it had to keep chugging along. You couldn't stop for vignettes.
I gotta tell her he's dead. Want some with me?
Not now. I promised this young lady some stockings and cigarettes.
Oh, yeah?
For her family, I know. First class people.
See you
later. I'm down. Yes, we're going. Up to my room.
Hey, Sarah, you better get off the streets pretty soon. It's almost curfew. You don't even have a pass.
We're entering what's been referred to as the Fellini section of the film.
Oh,
this
yeah.
Sort of walk through the city. Yeah, and again, traditionally, a sequence I think that would have music or some sort of emotional cue.
Exactly.
And yet is so evocative without it, but it's a trade-off.
It is a trade-off. I think wrongly thought it had to be as austere and non-button-pushing as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I think something was lost with that. You know, it's the funniest thing about movies, the most interesting thing, is that movies don't like good taste. And movies don't like austerity. They like, you know, all the things you'll see, the things that you're a little embarrassed about, that you think are show-off things. They're the ones that are most alive 20 years later. It's one of the most interesting things about movies is that they like showing off. It's life. It's vitality. Austerity and classicism just lay there.
Hmm. Well, although, you know, I think you could make the argument that carnal knowledge is sort of in that vein and yet is still very, very emotional, very much alive.
But there's plenty of show-off stuff in Carnal Knowledge.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, just both in the writing and the style.
Yeah. It's like that nice thing that the guys who made Four Weddings and a Funeral said. We were talking about it the other day. That one of the producers said, You know, the very, very first scene where the little girl that he rooms with wakes up and they're late and she says, fuck, 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 and says fuck about 30 times. The producer said, we needed that because we couldn't afford special effects.
We needed to get people's
attention.
Shock and get them going. And I think the flashy stuff has to be somewhere to get everybody's attention. And then with time, we had a big fight over this.
Who? You and Walken?
Me and Arkin.
Oh, really?
Because he screamed, what did you say?
Right.
And I said, no, Alan, I don't think so.
Oh, it's great the way he does it in the film. The length of time that he takes is perfect. And this is a beautiful shot where he walks into shadow and the shot of her. It's really, really terrific. You don't see that much anymore. People sort of, characters just going into darkness.
No.
Maybe there's a reason.
Maybe it's what we were just talking about.
You know, a shot like that.
I love that shot. I love
both these shots.
Yes.
Who is this? Who is the woman?
Her name is Eva Maltagliati. She was a great Italian actress. Again, didn't speak any English, but she sure got it. Watkin and I did have a big fight or two about Rome here. This is the shot we first fought about, this one. I said, you can't have... He had it all dull, you know, and I said, no, you have to now start bringing it up and doing stripes and...
No, it's funny you should mention that, because when I was watching it during the transfer, I noticed how completely different the lighting scheme is. It's all hard light.
I lit this, basically, because we were so in disagreement. He said, I don't know what you mean. Show me what you mean. I said, okay. And I did it. And I never knew how he felt about it, but I knew that for this event, for the new Milo,
mm-hmm.
and for the herding of people, for all the Nazi behavior, that we couldn't have our...
The
normal... Yeah. Right.
This is a great shot. How much dolly track?
This is
500 feet.
There's a guy called Porky that we loved was the dolly grip, and he ran with it, keeping up with the car, and keeping up with Alan, and on the last shot, he just let the dolly go and said, you're on your own. The world's greatest dolly grip.
Oh, it's
a guy is running in this shot.
It is endless. Look at that. You don't see that much anymore.
Take it easy, don't hurt him.
Now this exchange that comes up, which is a fantastic exchange, and I think literally the climax of his character.
Yes.
They don't need the money, they're rich, then they'll understand.
It's my favorite line.
Is Buck.
Yeah.
Those were the lines that Heller said, I wish I'd thought of those.
Yeah.
And it really, it's funny, it closes that loop. I think, in a way that's just so crucial.
Absolutely. It finishes that design and makes everything clear.
Shooting at night in Rome for a while, I guess. That must have been interesting.
It was fun. It was fun. And don't forget, you know, you take your break and you walk to a great restaurant. It was really a nice way to shoot.
60 shares in the syndicate.
What good is that? He's dead.
And his family will get it.
He didn't have time to have a family.
And his parents will get it.
They don't need it. They're rich.
Then they'll understand.
Buck also said that, I guess, near Houston was shooting there. Apparently the Kremlin letter, he said.
Right.
And he told this story that he saw Houston at a phone outside the stage. He said, I'm pretty sure he was placing a bet on something.
He always did.
And beside him, the red light is going on the soundstage. And he asked somebody later, is that normal for that to happen? He says, you know, every once in a while, John will sort of set everything up with the ADs and then walk out to make a phone call while they roll.
I mean, sometimes he used to go, I know an actor was in one of his pictures, and he'd say, you guys can block this out, you know what to do. And he would just go to his trailer and place his bets, and he was truly relaxed. Yeah. And this, and when we were here, we met Fellini, you know, and we all had dinner with Fellini. It was the most amazing conversation with him.
Fellini?
Yeah. And there was...
Oh, that's a great shot. You were saying?
There was, I'm just trying to remember, there's this woman, we got very friendly with that. You know the beautiful Garbo-like lady that keeps coming down the stairs in the
8th
and a half? We got very friendly with her and her daughter, and she said he wanted her to do a scene with some other women, a sex scene. And she said, Fellini kind of like this. I go home now. And I said, what do you do? She said, oh, you know Federico, he make a lot of smoke. She's in the scene, then she's not in the scene. He doesn't mind. He was relaxed, too.
Whether she was there or not didn't matter.
Nah.
Hello, you, sir.
Good. Where's your sister?
There. You giving me a dollar?
Yeah.
You go to America soon?
Sure, kid.
Ciao, you're sitting.
Hi.
You make love now?
No. Listen. I have to tell you something.
Buck also said that in part of the scene, did you shoot it where they start to fight and then they sort of get on the bed and things start to sort of happen between them?
Yes.
And then but the whole time she's planning to kill him.
And right where it gets interesting, she tries to stab him, but it was rough. It was rough. It was in for a long time, in fact. I mean, the scene.
Lately's dead.
Yeah, again, the light, obviously really harsh, hard.
The only over I ever shot to that date.
Really?
Yeah. I hated them.
You hated overs?
I was so wrong. I never did them. I think it's one of the things that adds to the coldness of this picture.
You mean you think psychologically having people together in a frame creates a sort of sense of connection?
Absolutely.
For the audience.
That's what we use it for, after all.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, and... When you see something like Sense and Sensibility, when there are only 18th century camera techniques and there are no overs because of the compositions of those paintings and all that, it's a very much a modern thing to realize that you can have a piece of somebody in the foreground, in the back of somebody, while you're looking at somebody else. It comes from movies, after all.
I was constantly in traffic trying to find a way to get behind a character, to shoot over them or across them or...
Absolutely.
Just to create that sense of people occupying the same space. That would have been a good role for me, I think. I, as we know from Schizopolis, it's right in my wheelhouse. You think you'd have trouble with the... With the Humane Society now, shooting the horse stuff?
Not only the horse, that I had a Legion of Decency situation for TV where I had to watch it with whoever it was. And there was, in the whorehouse scene with the old man, way up in the window, there was a girl bare-breasted, and he made me take her out, although there was no way to see her on the TV screen at all. We were watching this walk together, and he walks right by the blowjob, and the guy never saw it.
This is a really good scene coming up. Grodin is amazing in
it. Yes, he's very,
very, very creepy. These look like tough shots to do.
I believe.
Rail on either side, maybe?
I think it was a rail and one flight.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept changing the statue at the bottom.
I only raped her once. You killed her.
Oh, he's so, so creepy here. Look at the way he's in that corner.
This is all Cinecittà.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You remember that thing that Truffaut said about circles and corners?
No.
He said happiness is circular. It's people rolling over and over down a grass hill. Unhappiness is corners. It's what he did in Jules and Jim, in fact, when the tough time came. They were all in corners.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that shot of her blowing the smoke.
Exactly.
Pretending to be the train where she's going around in circles. Yeah.
Exactly.
Interesting. God, I wish I'd heard that before.
I've got to start over.
Don't you realize what you've done? You murdered a human being! They can hang you!
I hardly think they'll do that. Not the good old Arfie. I don't think they'd make such a fuss over one Italian girl when thousands of lives are being lost every day.
Arfie, listen. They're coming for you. They're coming to arrest you. You can't take the life of another human being and get away with it. Don't you understand that? They're coming to get you!
Captain Yossarian?
Yes?
You're under arrest.
But I'm...
You're AWOL.
We're sending you home.
What?
I said we're sending you home.
You know, Yossarian, you really have been...
Did you keep a jacket?
I did.
Did you?
Yeah, I don't have it anymore, but I did for years. We had all the clothes from there. I was very thin from the Academy Award just before. So all the clothes were great. All the pictures from this time of all of us were great. Wouldn't you give
your life for Colonel? Oh, the light is just always perfect. Now, Buck is very different in this scene in performance than he is in any other scene in the film. I mean, noticeably. I mean, very pitched very sort of naturalistically.
Well, we talked a lot about this really being the beginning
of the real
thing and of the real world and of agency guys, ad guys, execs.
Right.
The war is over and they are execs now.
Right.
And in some way you can see it. They have to.
Yeah, right. Now the two of them, they're very different.
It's like the guy in Hearts and Minds who says, you know, I'm new to exploitation.
Any more missions? No. In that case, we'll just have to send you home. Of course, there's one catch.
Yeah? What's that?
Well, we will issue orders sending you back to the States. And there's one thing you have to do for us in return.
What would that be?
Now, on these, you'd be right beside the camera then, right? Just sitting by the
lens
most often.
Well, Absolutely. And there were, of course, there was no video monitors. And I've thought so much about what you and Lester said to each other about how they divide you and the actors. And they are such a habit once you're used to them. You can't really give them up any more than you can give up earphones, the dialogue. There was no such thing here.
We're going to put you on Easy Street.
We're going to promote you to major.
We're going to give you another medal.
Glorify your exploits, send you home a hero.
You'll have parades in your...
Was it, is the story true that at one point when you were prepping, you told somebody, don't fuck with me, I've got the fifth largest air force in the world?
I'm sure it's true. I don't remember, but it sounds right. Arkin was so unhappy because I spent so much time with the technical part of it and plotting stuff like these planes going past him and all that. And he said, you could have spent a little more time with... Well, he said us, but he meant me. And he's right. But the technical stuff was very daunting.
Oh, it makes my head spin watching some of the shots in this film.
Well, what the hell? If they don't want to fly any more missions, let them stand up and say so like I did.
Nice little crane shot.
Yeah, that was the famous ramp.
Do you think you would have done something differently to make it more clear that this was an Ailey's horror? Or?
Oh, I think so. I think that...
What could you have done?
Well, I would have had to start with her the very... I would have had to...
To go into her?
Yes, yeah. All that stuff to go into her the first time we see her, to create her the way you do. You know, there are movies now that I'm very critical of that don't lift crucial events or moments or characters, and this was guilty of some of that without any question.
How did you do these shadows there?
These were planes. We didn't fool around. These were planes that went by.
You're kidding.
No, we had all these planes and we just used them. No wonder Arkin was discouraged.
Help him!
What?
Help him! Help him!
Help who?
Help the bombardier!
I'm a bombardier. I'm all right.
Then help him! Help him!
I gather it was important to have this look as realistic as possible.
Oh,
I mean, I've
yeah.
been in theaters where people, I mean, the gasps are audible.
Well, I worked and worked on it and made them do it over and over and said, I don't know, it doesn't look real yet. And then we got it, and ever from that point on, I've been unable to look at it. It didn't horrify us at all while we were doing it, because it was just about how you do it. And then it got sucked up by the movie and became what it is.
So now he's had his moment. His moment of confrontation. Or reliving that moment.
And he's free.
Which, and then we come up on a scene that I gather you sort of worked on for some time or played with.
We stopped dead.
Did you really?
Yeah. We got to that scene, and we rehearsed it to shoot, and I said, this is no good. I couldn't stand them saying these things to each other in this room. I knew how I wanted to start the scene. That was okay. And I loved how it looked.
Oh, look at that.
This was Silbert and Watkin at their very best. And then we stopped, and I sat there thinking for a couple of days. Oh, they were all so pissed off at me.
A couple of days?
Yeah.
Well...
Were you thinking, were you working with them? What were you, just trying anything?
People were making suggestions, and we would try things, we'd try ways of playing it. And then I said, everybody go away and just let me sit here. And finally, I had the idea that they would have the difficult dialogue after he jumped. And that worked.
Right.
And that was the style of the picture, and it was the nature of the idea that you couldn't just stand there and say...
You know. No, and I like how, no matter how far away he is, they're speaking as though they're 2 feet away from each other.
I like that, too.
Well, I'm going to call the deal off. If they want to send me home, I can do it because I've flown over 50 missions, not because I'm a stubborn son of a bitch.
They can't do that. They have to send home every man in the outfit.
One thing, although it's completely irrelevant to what we're watching... But it's too good a story not to discuss, was the legendary visit of John Wayne to the set.
Oh, God, I've kicked myself over that for ever since then. That John Wayne was landing in Guaymas and asked permission to use our landing strip. And at that time, you know, he was a kind of political opponent. I mean, he was so reactionary, and he had said and done some things not long before that had really pissed off Buck and me politically. No other reason than Oprah. And we were such prigs, such righteous schmucks, that when he landed, we didn't go out to say hello. And he was so angry that night in the hotel bar, he got very drunk and fell off his stool and broke his ankle. And Buck and I both were furious at ourselves for years and years. And I met him and apologized and spent a little time with him after, years after. And he was a gentleman, of course. He was fine about it. But we were not proud.
Yeah, we have another super long take, our creep going here, culminating with him jumping out the window.
Yeah, well, this was all, once I had that idea, then I could design all this for that.
Right.
It's a miracle.
It's no miracle. He has to have planned it.
And again, even back, following the idea we were talking about before, even Richard Benjamin in the scene, again, pitched very naturalistically, you know, in the same vein as Cathcart and Korn. You know, there's
the
just a whole
over.
Tonal shift.
Yeah. The war isn't over, but their war is over.
He got it!
And Perkins, now Perkins had worked with Wells.
Oh, yes.
Did he give you a heads up at all? Or?
Oh, yes. He told me a great deal about him. He worshipped Wells. And I had Wells was not wonderful on the set, and he wouldn't have dinner with me. And when we were finished, he said, let's have dinner. And he just, you know, knocked me out. He was, everything he said was true and beautiful. He was great. And I could see what Perkins was talking about. And what I never knew until I read a book 20-some years later is that Wells had tried to get Catch-22 to make himself. And no wonder he was annoyed that this squirt was doing it when he couldn't.
Are you glad now you didn't know that?
Very glad. Yeah. I was already semi-paralyzed at the idea that Orson Welles was there, and I was supposed to tell him what to do. But if I knew that he wanted to do Catch-22, it would have been a disaster.
This is a pretty spectacular helicopter shot.
Yeah, it was very good
one
helicopter
of the early
work.
Ones.
Yes, and it was the beginning. I mean, Nelson Tyler was there.
Oh, look at that. Holy cow.
And this was...
Nelson Tyler, the Tyler cameraman.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in those days, I mean, you lined up a shot. If you were the director, you went up and you hung out of the helicopter and I'm acrophobic, and I thought, well, I'll have a heart attack, and it'll be their problem. But I discovered that if you keep looking through the camera while you're hanging out of the helicopter, it's okay. And this was pretty close for a helicopter.
Very.
And the endless, the usual thing of not seeing the wind on the water from the prop and all.
How was that achieved?
I was behind us.
Did you always feel this was where you wanted to end up?
Yes. This was always our ending, I think from Buck's first draft. Mm-hmm. But how to shoot it and what it was going to be, I didn't know. It's like seeing the names of your high school class. We were there so long. You know every single person very well.
Well, thank you for that.
Thank you.